Just before we get into the discussion of the Islamic Republic and its constitution, let's just lay it out bare. What was Iran like prior to the 1979 Islamic Revolution?
Well, I think it was pretty Westoxified. The reality is that all of that region was, if not post-colonial, most of the Muslim world, it was suffering from a post-colonial sort of hangover, or they'd been under the boot of one form of imperialism or another. They'd suffered all sorts of, oppression, famines. Goodness knows, Iran itself was the subject of, I think, something like 10 or 11 million people dying as a result of imposed famines by foreign powers. So the fact is that the Iranian establishment under the Shah was a despotic one. It was primarily there to serve the purposes of the Anglo-Zionist empire. Even then, they protected him, they brought him to power, they protected him, they destroyed democracy under Mossadegh, they organized coup d'etats, riled up gangs, and then the system that was imposed was primarily to siphon oil, gas, and all the wealth and resources from Iran to the West, and the Shah duly obliged. The casualties were people in the rural areas. The casualties were people's lack of education, their lack of employment, their you know, a disparity on so many social metrics that it's hard to sort of go through them all. And if we did that comparison, which I'm sure we will as the program goes on, you'll see that pre-79 revolutionary Iran and post-79 revolutionary Iran is hugely different in one factor in itself, is that it is economically, culturally, politically, militarily, scientifically far better off today than it was under that period. And the most important thing is it has its independent sovereignty. It's a truly sovereign and independent nation, which isn't under the yoke of either the World Bank or any of the other, if you like, usual money mafia puppet masters that this globe seems to have to deal with now. The fact of the matter is that women's position itself is important to mention. Women weren't even in universities. They weren't even in employment. I mean, now at least you've got maybe 60% employment amongst women. You've got sort of increase of universities. There's actually sort of thousands of universities at which the women participate on an equal basis as well. So many factors that are different from now from then.
We are going to go into detail about what exactly has improved and how Iran has changed so much since 1979. But, Batul, let me bring you in first of all, because I want to ask you about it's astonishing, the fact that so many people overwhelmingly in Iran, I think it was close to like 100%, voted in favour of an Islamic Republic. What were they voting for exactly, and why do you think they were voting basically for Islam in Iran to rule over?
Absolutely. I think if we want to talk about the extraordinary nature of the Islamic Revolution, we first have to put it within the scene of the wider political context. So, of course, at that time, you had the Soviet Union that was in the East, you had capitalism that was in the West. And so, essentially, you had this new identity that was rising on the international scene, and that was the identity of Islam. That was that Islam had now become the real identity and the true determining factor for the people and for the society of Iran. And that was something that was unprecedented, because here, of course, the world acknowledges religion as a system of governance for the individual. But for the Iranian people, that was a way for them to kind of get rid of the shackles that was imposed on them, as Sayyid Mohsen Abbas has mentioned, through Iran that was inherently a client state of the U.S. And we have to understand the context of this is that the US was emerging as a global superpower and the Soviet Union was crumbling. So for a nation to come and to basically have no external outside support, for that backing to essentially be removed and for that nation to be isolated, but to still go in pursuit of these objectives because they ultimately believed that the principles need to overshadow the nation's interest. And Imam Khomeini's leadership was such that he gave the people agency. He expected the change to come from them, such that their presence on the streets is what will lead to this change. And ultimately, we see that the Islamic Republic essentially rested on the people approving the system. It is through the system that changes are made, essentially, and progress is achieved if it proves unworkable in any field. And the system also proved that it had the ability to be dynamic and to basically regenerate itself if any problems essentially surfaced. And that was ultimately due to the wisdom of the a leadership that continues until today, that has the ability to really absorb the masses. We see that in the trajectory of Iran throughout these decades, actually, we see that those that have been in power have not been the quote-unquote hardliners. You've had more of actually the reformists in power who maybe when it comes to the ideals of the revolution don't support it as much as the, you know, the West likes to call them the quote-unquote hardliners. Again, that shows you that in Iran, really, there is that space and there is that scope to absorb the reaction of the masses. And ultimately, it is driven by the people.
It's funny, isn't it, that Iran, if you look at Western mainstream media, they claim that, you know, it's oppressive in many ways. It doesn't allow freedom of speech. It doesn't allow freedom of the press. It doesn't allow women's rights. But actually, when you look at the situation, there's much more freedoms in many ways than I think you find here under this current Islamophobic atmosphere that we live in right now. Mohsin, I want to bring you in again because what I want to understand is some specifics. The constitution, I think, that was implemented afterwards, which is based on Islamic teachings, has changed and evolved as the country has evolved. Could you just go into a little bit of detail about what exactly is unique about this Islamic constitution that exists now?
Well, Velayat-e Faqih is really ruled by the jurists. So the jurists in Islamic context basically apply themselves to the science of the Quran and the science of Hadith, using those tools and rationality and reason and other, you know, tools of logic. They come up with laws and rules and regulations for a society to exist. But they are laws and rules which have a common heritage within the people of the book, if you like. So Christians, Jews, I mean, Judeo-Christian original actual principalists will recognize that the virtue ethics on which the Islamic Republic of Iran is based, the virtue ethics of the prophets, the virtue ethics, obviously, of the Prophet Muhammad specifically, are all what drive the laws, the constitution, the policies, the principles, and the policy, the general policies of Iran throughout. And if you measured those ethics and that morality against their reality, what you'd find is, if you looked at their foreign policy, for instance, and you measured it, they said that they would support Palestine and the freedom of Palestine. They said that they would support the oppressed against the oppressors. They said that they would, be a any kind of threat to their partners and their sort of their neighbors. And you've seen just on that policy, if you were to measure them up, they supported the Palestinians. They've supported the Yemeni oppressed. They've supported the oppressed in Syria. They've stood against Anglo-Zionist imperialism and suffered the worst sanctions that the world has ever seen on a nation. You know, the maximum pressure translates into literally starving and boycotting Iran on every level that you can imagine economically. No country would be able to sustain this had it not had the resistance economy and the will and the spiritual, moral, fortitude. And I think relying on Islam, relying on that spirituality is what's allowed them to weather these storms and come up with solutions, pragmatic solutions. Clearly, there are things that they would like to do. I mean, one of the principal ones is to have no link, if you like, to the usurious economic system of the world and the World Bank and such like entities. They would like to be able to see that there's no Anglo-American influence at all in the West. But these things are sort of macro, long-term objectives, which clearly they're not being allowed to implement. And they're under huge military, as well as psychological, cultural attack constantly. So you have to measure Iran's entire policy and its value system against the value system that it's up against. The value system it's up against and it's consciously fighting against is one of neoliberalism. It's of rampant imperialism. And I think for Iran to stand stoically by the principles set by its original, its pioneers, and Ayatollah Khomeini in particular, is hugely creditable because they could easily have collapsed into just selling out and buying their way into the global system. They haven't. They've stuck to those principles.
I think that that's a very strong point to end on for the time being as we come away from the discussion. Well, let's come back to the discussion now. Batul, let me bring you in on this again, because you said something earlier on which I appreciated very much. It was the fact that Iran chose Islam and it went its own route, not just, you know, through self-determination, you know, through their own constitution, but the fact that they chose their own political way. They didn't go for the left wing or the right wing based on what other countries are leading, spearheading. They went for their own system, which fell into Islam, the lack of Islam. And also, I think what you mentioned before about it being, it's a democracy. People don't like to admit this, but Iran is a democracy and remains a democracy ever since 1979. Perhaps you could just explain for people who don't are not aware of this point, how is Iran's a democracy? How does it work?
All right. Essentially, so Iran is based on a democratic theocracy, which basically means that the constitution is Islam. The reason that the constitution is Islam, because as we are alluding to, it's the people who have actually voted for the system to come into place. Now, in order for Iran to be able to protect and to strengthen its nation, there were many different power institutions that were established. And the reality of these power institutions is that they are designed to monitor each other, to not allow for any diversion or abduction by those in power. And the reality of it is that it creates a kind of adhesive relationship between the leaders and the people, because the people feel like they have agency within the system. Because you see that within all of those power dynamics and institutions and within all those elected officials, they are either directly or indirectly elected by the people. So let me give an example. You have the supreme leader in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. He is elected from 88 mujtahids who form the Assembly of Experts. Essentially, these are jurists who the nation of Iran decide on, essentially. They go out and they vote to say that we want these individuals to form as part of the Assembly of Experts. And essentially, not only do they elect the supreme leader, but they monitor the supreme leader to ensure that actually he is acting within the bounds of the constitution. So even the supreme leader in this regards is not kind of given a free pass. And if we see that, for example, you have also the Islamic Consultative Assembly, which is the Islamic Iranian parliament, essentially, you have the Guardian Council, which is made up of 12 jurists, fuqaha, who basically ensure that the Islamic constitution is being followed through any of the laws that are passing through. So what this shows is actually there's a democracy on many levels. It's through the officials that get elected, and it's also through the fact of honouring the constitution that these people have asked for. The reason the nation of Iran asked for an Islamic constitution is because it realises that in order for real change to happen, Islam cannot be secular. Islam cannot apply just on the personal individual sphere. It has to be in power. But when Islam is in power, that is actually how real change is created. And we see that actually Iran is the only country in the world, I would argue, today, that actually says what it says without being afraid, you know. Even, for example, if we look at Russia, even if we look at China, they didn't send fuel shipments to Venezuela, for example, when it was under sanctions. Mm-hmm. But Iran did. Iran, as Sayyid Mohsen Abbas was saying, has complete agency and freedom. We have to understand that freedom, this aspect of dignity and izzah, is inherent to Islam. Islam says that as an individual, you might as well be dead if you are captive and shackled to entities other than God. So the vision of the Islamic Revolution was that only God can tell me how I can live my life and how things should be administered, and no other external power. And this essentially has to happen through the people. That's a prerequisite. And that's why I would argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran today is a real Islamic governance, because despite the so-called dynasties that have existed, you know, after the advent of the governance of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in Medina, all of them have used Islam as a cover for their interests, you know, whether it's Banu Umayyah, Banu Abbas, all the way one can argue to the Ottoman Empire, to Saudi Arabia today. But when you have a nation in which its principles overshadow its nation's interests and it is fearless in the pursuit of social justice, then you know it's based on something substantial.
For sure. And Sayyid, I want to bring you in again, because you mentioned something earlier on about the fact that, you know, women's rights in Iran have improved fundamentally. Their ability to gain an education has flourished ever since the revolution took place. I think what I take from the revolution is that the lower classes in Iran, the poorer working class people, if you like, they also benefited tremendously from this revolution. I think, again, it falls on the principles of Islam, because Islam says you should help the downtrodden, you should be charitable, you should provide an education for all. And I think that that's a point worth emphasising. It wasn't just women, it wasn't just working class, many people have benefited. Perhaps you could go into more detail.
I think the rural classes are certainly the biggest winners. because they were neglected on a scale which is, you know, actually quite shocking. I mean, the Shah of Iran had no concern for the rural farmers, and actually Iran is a fundamentally agricultural society, as even today. I mean, it's agricultural. Although water is a problem, some of the economic, the climate change issues are hitting Iran more adversely than other places. But nonetheless, they're still very self-sufficient in that regard because of that rural outfit. But he regarded them as basically peasants who were to be exploited, the old serf kind of autocrat kind of relationship. That changed in 1979, clearly. Education-wise, households themselves, in terms of having basic amenities like electricity or supply of gas, you know, 85 to 90% of homes have gas and electricity now. These are just little basic things, and the government has intervened to make sure this happens. In terms of employment, of course, there are problems because of this maximum pressure business and the hugely problematic kind of global environment in which Iran is subjected to these kind of sanctions. And that has caused some problems in terms of lack of employment. But there, even that, over the last 10 years or so, Iran has found solutions through the resistance economy, through generating its own industries, through developing its own technologies. And the companies that are protected within Iran to be able to develop things for those rural masses and for the urban classes has been fair. I think nobody can argue against that. I think building a civilizational plan which is going to last for the next 40 years or so has been something that Ayatollah Khamenei has been focusing on very much so, and he talks quite often about this. And that dream, the prophetic dream, is manifested in the Khamenei dream, I think, and the Khomeini dream. And it is, first and foremost, to look after the welfare of the people, to look after their needs. That is primary. The second thing is not to be selfish, rather like the imperialist Western neoliberal philosophy, which is, I'm all right, Jack, let's plunder everything, make ourselves happy and nice and fat on the misery of other people around the world. Iran is not doing that. Iran is saying, collaboration, cooperation. This is very Islamic. This is at the heart of it. Of course, issues like charity, these are commonplace. Family is really important and is still being built upon. And all these things rival Agenda 2030, for instance, and the push from the global elitists to actually create a more narcissistic, a more individualistic, a more a broken society, because that suits their control agendas. Mm. Iran is not doing that. Iran is saying family is vital. So you'll go to Iran even today, and one of the most powerful things I note is that maintenance of those kind of natural ties. So I think that the society is healthy. Its only complaint will be the economic one in terms of jobs. I think that's the only legitimate thing. And even that is not entirely, of course, the fault of the government necessarily.
Mostly down to sanctions issues, which are, of course, a cruel Western tactic to try and undermine the Islamic Republic, which has failed, essentially, until now. Batul, we haven't got long left of the show, so I want to end it on you if I can. I think one thing that Iran has done very well is it's helped other Muslims outside of Iran as well. That's something which I've noticed, and you, I think, recently went to Lebanon and Iraq, so you would see some of the benefits that has come about from the 1979 revolution and so on. Could you just perhaps detail if this is actually the case? Has Muslims across the Ummah benefited as well as Iranians from the Islamic revolution?
Right. So I'd start off by saying that Iran has an open hand policy. So it looks to support anyone who asks for that help, essentially, and are an oppressed people. So this is even outside of the scopes of if we want to talk about the Muslim Ummah. You know, you have examples of South Africa, you have examples of, you know, Venezuela, Cuba, etc., just to name a few. If we want to talk on the military front, for example, you know, the examples of, you know, defeating ISIS get brought up, you know, the role that Haj Qasem Soleimani played in this regards, the support for the Palestinian liberation. But even in Iraq, when Bush the First invaded during the Gulf War, you saw that Iran actually united with those entities that had previously fought Iran within Iraq in order to basically focus on the main arch enemy, and that is to get rid of the American occupation. So even in this regards, Iran has demonstrated that actually it possesses many characteristics which has enabled it to not only sustain itself, but to grow stronger and stronger. So, for example, the aspect of being patient, the aspect of not allowing the enemy to drag them into the square that they want them to get dragged into. Mm. They don't react emotionally, right? They react on the on the basis of principles. So they can, for example, distinguish between the primary enemy and the secondary enemy, for example. In other regards, you know, for example, it has set up the Shahid Foundation, you know, that supports the families of martyred individuals within Iraq. You have within Nigeria as well, through the Islamic movement of Nigeria headed by Sheikh Ibrahim Segzaki. You have the support through the creation of infrastructure, electricity in Iraq, that the Islamic Republic has been very much involved in. So it's not only in the military sphere, but I think the most important thing is that what the Islamic Republic has done is it's set a model for the rest of the countries in the region. It's set a model for Lebanon. It's set a model for Yemen. It's set a model for Iraq. It's set a model even for Pakistan, for Afghanistan. When we look at all these paramilitary organizations that have emerged that are basically fighting against the hegemonic powers in the pursuit for freedom, that is all inspired from the principles of the Islamic Revolution. And that's something that the leaders of those movements themselves would tell you.
Well, thank you to both of you for your comments today. It's been very enlightening, but unfortunately we are out of time. That is all the time we have, unfortunately. But don't worry, we will be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Thank you to everyone at home. Assalamu alaikum for now.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
Imam Khomeini's speech on the holy month of Ramadan. We hope that by the grace of the holy month, that is the feast of connection, we can also reap benefits so that we can overcome the problems befallen upon us. Not all the things brought by prophets aimed at the essence. Establishment of government is not for the prophets an essential purpose. All their invitation is prelude to awakening of human beings and making man understand what man has been, what he is and what he will be, and that how the world is and what relationship it has with the sacred essence of Allah Almighty.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear sisters and brothers from all over the world, you are listening to Spring of the Truth from IRB English Radio. In this program, we recite some of the sentences and speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the great marja and the political leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Since we are in the holy month of Ramadan, today we want to speak about this month in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. In that regard, he says, with the beginning of the month of Ramadan, it is necessary that nation uses its unity to stand against the tyranny of the time and the international oppressive nations who deprive Muslim nations of their rights. This part of the speech of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh concerns the unity of a Muslim nation in front of either internal or external tyrannies. Muslims should take the opportunity in this month and stand against any oppression set against them. A really famous example of such a movement is represented on Al-Quds Day, which was first founded and called so by Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. It is in the last Friday of the month of Ramadan in which demonstrations are held across the world to protest against the corruption of Palestine.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. Salli ala.
As we said, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh on this day called on Muslims to dedicate this day to demanding the rights of the oppressed Muslims around the world and particularly those in Palestine. On this day, rallies are organized before Friday prayer to protest against the corruption of Palestine and the oppression of its people. We can see that how much Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh was concerned about other Muslim nations, which were deprived of their rights to be free. You know, such great soul of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh was so big that not only the people of his own nation, but also every Muslim nation around the world were within the circle of his attention. Well, that's all the time we've got for today. For ending, let's just recite this sentence of Imam Khomeini about month of Ramadan. In that regard, he said, within the beginning of the month of Ramadan, it is necessary that the nation uses its unity to stand against the tyranny of the time and the international oppressive nations who deprive Muslim nations of their rights.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to these verses. Verse 200, 201, and 202.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
كذلك سلكناه في قلوب المجرمين.
Thus have we inserted disbelief into the hearts of the criminals.
لا يؤمنون به حتى يروا العذاب الأليم.
They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment.
فيأتيهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون.
And it will come to them suddenly while they perceive it not.
كذلك سلكناه في قلوب المجرمين. Thus we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners. لا يؤمنون به حتى يروا العذاب الأليم. They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. فيأتيهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون. And it shall come upon them all of a sudden while they are not aware. In these couple of verses, dear listeners, we understand that the Almighty Allah always completes the argument for the mankind. And it is even true with the pagans. So Allah exposes it to them and causes it to pass into their hearts. But if there is not any receptivity, even the Quran is not effective. So in this verse, therefore, he says, كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ. Thus, we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners. Allah sent the Qur'an down with clear statements in the language of their own people, and unto a man from among them who was well acquainted with their customs, and its content had been confirmed by the former divine books. Now, what else did they need? That's why, as you might remember, in the previous verses we read, أَوَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُمْ آيَةٌ. Is it not a sign to them? أَنْ يَعْلَمَهُ عُلَمَاءُ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ. Even this fact alone, the fact that the children, learned children of Israel, knew about it, must suffice them to believe in the contents and the call of the Holy Qur'an. But they do not believe. But yet, Almighty Allah always completes the arguments, even with the pagans. كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ. Thus, we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء لي الدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, in short, كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ means Allah sent the Qur'an with all the conditions which made the acceptance of it easy for the Jews in the hearts of those sinful people. But those diseased hearts denied accepting it. They negated it. It is like the sound nutritious food that a sick stomach does not receive. It is because of that stomach, because of the receptivity, and that's why it rejects it. So the verse says, لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِهِ حَتَّى يَرَوُ الْعَذَابَ الْأَلِيمِ But they will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. The Arabic phrase, سَلَكْنَاهُ, in the beginning of the first verse, is derived from the word سُلُك, which means passing a way, coming from one side and going out from another side. Yet, they do not believe in it until the divine punishment suddenly overtakes them while they do not perceive. Yet, it was passed into their hearts, but they did not want to listen, but they did not want to believe. So the verse says, لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِهِ حَتَّى يَرَوُ الْعَذَابَ الْأَلِيمِ They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً The Holy Quran continues, and it shall come upon them all of a sudden. No doubt, the purpose of this divine punishment, which suddenly seizes them, is the worldly chastisement and the destructive affliction, which is called istisal, the divine punishment for the unchangeable sinners. فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً It comes upon them all of a sudden. And the ugly and beautiful rites and traditions, and in other words, racial bigotries work as a curtain of ignorance which covers the man's thoughts, apprehension, and wisdom, and bars that correct judgment works. So this is how they did not believe. لا يؤمنون به. It was because of this ignorance. It was because of this racial bigotry. This state of bigotry has a harsher form among some tribes. For example, a group of Arabs were known as zealous people, and they are referred to in these verses even. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled
It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Sham-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan, but that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khure Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khure Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilag. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.